Silence in a democracy weakens the democracy.
A lot of people in the United States, in my opinion,
don't see that there's ordinary people in Iraq.
They see it as just one person.
There seems to be more people that are open to understanding what is really behind the US's agenda and why should Australia go in there at all.
We feel betrayed. We want our money back. We want our country back. That's amazing language for high-profile donors of the Republican Party.
We know what we're talking about when we say the people are the ones who are going to suffer, not Saddam Hussein.
There's a great movement going on right now, so I don't think that they can continue to ignore this voice.
This is Pacifica's Peace Watch for Tuesday, January 21st, 2003. I'm Verna Avery Brown. The Bush administration continues to make its case and prepare militarily for war against Iraq, but support for the president's agenda is losing ground in some diplomatic circles and in the court of public opinion. Anywhere between 200,000 to 500,000 anti-war protesters, some carrying signs that read "Freezing for Peace," turned out this weekend in Washington, D.C. Another 200,000 rallied in San Francisco, and demonstrations were held in approximately 100 cities worldwide. In total, nearly 1 million protesters have come out against a war with Iraq. Support in conservative circles is also waning. The president's ratings have slipped from a popular 68% down to a less popular 56% in 45 days, according to a Newsweek ABC poll. France today announced it will wage a major diplomatic fight to block a UN resolution calling for war against Iraq and threaten to use its veto power if necessary. UN analyst Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies says France This announcement today is consistent with its position all along.
It's a slightly higher profile statement of opposition. They were a little bit cautious. They said that there's nothing today that provides evidence that would justify a war. But they are throwing down the gauntlet to the Bush administration. They're indicating that they are not prepared to sit back and accept a U.S. resolution in the U.N. I think that this was anticipated by Washington in the discussions we've been hearing about the likelihood of a so-called war of a coalition of the willing, as the Bush administration likes to put it, rather than a war justified by a UN resolution. In fact, of course, such a coalition would not at all be a coalition of the willing. It would be a coalition of the coerced. But nonetheless, I think that there's a growing sense in Washington that a UN resolution authorizing war may in fact be out of reach.
How likely are others within the UN Security Council to follow France's lead?
France's lead is very key. I think if there is going to be a veto, it would have to come from France. Both China and Russia, who staked out positions against the war in the foreign ministers' meeting over the last couple of days, implied that they could use a veto, although neither of them said so explicitly. But both of those countries are far more eager to remain on the good side of Washington than they are willing to challenge Washington directly. Without an explicit kind of leadership from France, I think it's unlikely that any other country would veto. What we might see, however, is the possibility of a massive move towards abstention in the Council. And it's possible that the U.S. could find that it's impossible even to get the 9 necessary positive votes in favor of war. Some of the smaller countries on the Council, like Angola, like Mexico, certainly Germany has taken a very strong anti-war position. Guinea, Cameroon, and Pakistan even, all of these countries which are in fact dependent on the United States but face massive public opposition to a war, they may not be willing to vote no, but they may be willing to abstain. And if there are enough abstentions, the U.S. simply won't get the 9 requisite positive votes they need.
Now, if the U.N. Deems that it's important enough to go ahead with this war without the backing of the U.N. Security Council, would that make it an illegal war?
If the U.S. goes to war without the Security Council, it is absolutely an illegal war. The U.N. Charter is very, very clear. It's vague about some things, but it's very clear about when a war is legal. A war is legal in only 2 circumstances. One, if the Security Council votes for it. In this case, that hasn't happened. The other, if there's a direct, immediate case of self-defense, meaning a country has been invaded or is about to imminently be invaded. We don't have that either. Absent one of those two criteria, this is an illegal war. The U.S. can call it whatever it wants, a coalition of anything, mm-hmm. but that doesn't make it legal.
So the coalition of the willing, if it's not a majority vote on this U.N. Security Council, would be a coalition of the illegal.
It would be a coalition of the criminal.
Okay. Phyllis, what overall does this really say about the Bush administration's agenda to launch a war? Are we seeing here a real shifting in the world opinion? And why do you think that's happening, if so?
I don't think we're seeing a shifting in the world opinion. World opinion has always been against this war. What we're seeing is a shift in the willingness of governments around the world to speak out in a way that reflects that public opposition. And simultaneously, we're seeing an escalation in anti-war mobilization here at home. Certainly the massive demonstrations of the Martin Luther King week, particularly the huge demonstrations on Saturday, as well as the mobilizations within the African-American community and the church communities yesterday on Martin Luther King Day itself, are further isolating the Bush administration. I think what we're seeing is a recognition within at least some members of the Bush administration about just how isolated they really are. And as a result, they're considering ways where they might be able to find a face-saving way of declaring victory and getting out without a war.
I.e., floating suggestions that they would not be opposed to Saddam Hussein going into exile.
Absolutely. This is one of the indications we're seeing that the U.S. is looking for alternative ways out, alternatives to war. Certainly the question of exile is not a new one. It's been on the agenda for a while. A number of Arab countries have been working on the issue. I think more significantly, there's a Russian initiative underway at the same time. There's a Russian foreign minister, a Russian deputy foreign minister on the ground in Baghdad as we speak. And I think that this is one of the issues being addressed. Certainly, exile in Russia would be seen as better protection for Saddam Hussein, his family, and whatever other leaders from the Baghdad regime went into exile. I don't think they would trust any Arab government to be able to provide protection. Exile in Russia would be understood to have the full backing of the United States. On the other hand, it's certainly possible that Saddam Hussein, who might agree to exile if he believed that it would give him the possibility of someday coming back to power, would see that as much less likely from exile in Russia than exile in an Arab country much closer to Iraq. So it's a big question whether this is a likely possibility or not.
Phyllis, I kind of want to review all of the events that have taken place of late that may be forcing the Bush administration to rethink its agenda towards war. If you look at the fact that hundreds of thousands, possibly a million, have protested just this past weekend in various cities around the country and around the world against this war, and you also look at France's position this morning, vowing to block the resolution. At the same time, you have the North Korea factor that has to be considered here. What kind of steps has the Bush administration had to reconsider with regard to this war?
I think that they are facing an extraordinary crisis, a real crisis of legitimacy, even within their own party. Certainly, the massive street demonstrations have been very important in showing the breadth and depth of opposition throughout the United States. The New York Times editorial on Monday warned the Bush administration that it must take seriously what is inherent in seeing demonstrations of that size. But I think even beyond the street demonstrations, there is a massive level of opposition emerging within elite circles within the Republican Party itself. Whatever Bush administration ideologues think of 100,000 or 200,000 people marching in Washington and another 50 to 100,000 marching in San Francisco, whatever they may think about that, they have to be very concerned about the Republican financial donors who are becoming disenchanted in such a high-profile public way as the group of Republican Party donors who took out a full-page ad in the Wall Street Journal last week who said in their ad, and the lead instigator of the ad was someone who had donated several $100,000 to the Republican Party. They said very clearly, we supported the Gulf War, we supported the war in Afghanistan, but we don't support this war. And they went on to use incredibly strong language. We feel betrayed. We want our money back. We want our country back. That's amazing language for high-profile donors of the Republican Party. And I would imagine that Bush's political advisors, people like Andrew Card and Karl Rove, whatever the strategists are thinking, those people have to be shaking in their boots saying, this war may not help us get elected next time around.
UN analyst Phyllis Bennis of the Institute for Policy Studies. There's a growing sense of uneasiness as talk of a possible assassination of Iraqi President Saddam Hussein continues. U.S. intelligence has stepped up their efforts to track and monitor the Iraqi president. Political commentators and host of Taking Aim of Pacifica Station WBAI in New York, Ralph Schoenman and Maya Schoen, weigh in on the question.
The United States has stepped up its military and intelligence efforts to track and to assassinate Iraqi President Saddam Hussein. Teams of U.S. Special Operations Forces and CIA paramilitary units, satellite imagery, radio intercepts, and airborne reconnaissance are involved, U.S. intelligence officials told USA Today.
Actually, Maya, it's over 100 U.S. Special Operations Forces and more than 60 CIA killer operatives who have been put in force and put into play in Iraq's deserts and outside its major cities since September. Senior U.S. and Arab intelligence officials confirmed this, and it was elaborated on in the Boston Globe report. U.S. forces include Green Berets, Navy SEALs, and Delta Force, and they're scouting landing strips for U.S. aircraft, and they're training Kurdish and Shiite operatives for the same purpose.
A converted Boeing 707, Ralph, is flying 10 hours a day, every day over Iraq, recording conversations of top Iraqi officials and pinpointing the location of these calls to within a mile. Two satellites, codenamed Micron and Trumpet, are intercepting calls and walkie-talkie transmissions from Iraqi military sites, Saddam Hussein's motorcade, his palaces, and other areas, tracking his every movement.
And all this is being done under the authorization that President Bush gave, directing the CIA to undertake a covert program to assassinate Saddam Hussein. Bush's directive to the Central Intelligence Agency is clear. U.S. forces are to kill the Iraqi leader, Saddam Hussein. For 27 years, the U.S. man in Baghdad, installed by the CIA, has been reinvented as a demon to provide a pretext for war and for the U.S. seizure of Iraqi oil. Who is the terrorist? The state terrorists are located in Washington, D.C.
This is
Ralph Schoenman
and Maya Schoen.
In a marathon day of peace and justice workshops and 5 hours of passionate speeches at Plymouth Congregational Church, Black Voices for Peace sponsored a Martin Luther King program with over 3,000 people in attendance. These students, traditionally a catalyst voice for change and renewal, were well represented in the event. Demario Solomon Simmons from Oklahoma recited, "I also have a dream."
I too have a dream. I have a dream that the media and others realize Dr. King was not some dreamer who gave one speech in 1963, but worked tirelessly for the total liberation and salvation of the entire Black nation. I have a dream that Dr. King's image is no longer hijacked by white supremacists and corporate leaders who hated and resisted him at all turns to now promote their evil agendas. I have a dream that Dr. King's image is no longer hijacked by Black reactionary and weak leaders and organizations to promote their weak, ineffective, and bourgeois agendas. You know who you are. I have a dream that one day, the world over, people will be free from oppression and misery and poverty and lack of health, adequate food, water, and shelter, and education. I have a dream that one day, this country will repent and adequately redress the irrefutable, undeniable, and unmitigated damage, horror, and mayhem done to African people. I have a dream to be 1 million Black men in college and not in prison. I have a dream that the Black community does not suffer the tremendous casualties during the so-called war on terrorism as we suffered during the so-called war on drugs. I have a dream that Black Haitians receive the same treatment as Cubans. I have a dream that one day I will not get that sinking feeling in my gut when a police car pulls behind me, even though I'm an educated black man. I have a dream that all black elected officials, including the CBC, will support and fight for reparations. I have a dream that strong black leadership like Cynthia McKinney will not be ridiculed by the white power structure for taking constitutional and principled stands. I have a dream that strong black leaders like Cynthia McKinney will not be abandoned by the black power structure for taking constitutional and principled stands. I have a dream that black people will gather like this one day and celebrate the lives of Harriet Tubman, Denmark Destin, Nat Turner, David Walker, Avery P. McAbee, Frederick Douglass, Malcolm X, Marcus Garvey, Dr. Carl G. Woodson. One love.
Demario Solomon Simmons from Oklahoma. Former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia also addressed the standing room only crowd.
Dr. King warned us that we have guided missiles and misguided men. And it is to the misguided men in Washington, D.C., who want to send us to war that we speak today. For justice, for peace, at home and abroad. We won't forget that your brother trampled on the voting rights of the poor and of people of color to put you in the White House, a privilege you did not earn. Where is your mandate, Mr. President, to take this country to war? We will not forget that while you push your plan to drill oil in Alaska, you still haven't told us the role that Enron played in shaping your plan. We won't forget that John McCain, even John McCain, has criticized the corporate war profiteering that's taking place now. And Mr. President, did you know that your new Treasury Secretary's company has decided to sell all their ships to the Carlyle Group? And in our quest for justice at home, Mr. President, we won't forget that Halliburton received an unlimited contract of 10 years duration to supply food and support to our troops who are fighting on the front lines of this war against terrorism. And our troops, we won't forget that our troops are getting sick from Halliburton's food.
Former U.S. Congresswoman Cynthia McKinney of Georgia, consumer advocate Ralph Nader addressed the crowd on how the U.S. got into the plans for war against Iraq in the first place and how it can get out of it.
In 1961, the then dictator of Iraq rolled his tanks toward Kuwait because Iraq has always claimed Kuwait, which is carved up by the British mandate after World War I. And the Kuwaitis called on a couple British battalions who flew to Kuwait, and then the Iraqi tanks went back to Baghdad. 30 years later, then dictator and now dictator rolled his tanks toward Kuwait. There was almost 2.5 weeks where these maneuvers were under aerial surveillance by the British and the United States. All we had to do is have a couple battalions fly to Kuwait, instead of having our diplomats say to the ruler of Iraq, we don't get involved in intra-Arab struggle. And those tanks would have gone back. It was the most preventable war of the century. It was a war for oil. That's why the war occurred. And then after that war, over 1 million Iraqi civilians have died, over 500,000 children. Because, as a progressive magazine pointed out, our military policy deliberately targeted electric companies and drinking water systems in order to destroy the public infrastructure, which led to cholera and all kinds of infant and small child deaths. It's important to note that Saddam Hussein is a threat to his own people. That's another issue of what our world and what our world community does with dictators who brutalize their people. But that is not why Mr. Bush is beating the drums of war. He's beating the drums of war because he states that the dictator in Iraq is a threat to others, including ourselves. Notwithstanding a massive propaganda barrage for the last 8 months, the majority of the American people still say in the polls that he has not proven the case that Saddam Hussein is a threat to the United States. He is in control of one-third of his country only. His military, according to the Pentagon, is one-third the strength it was in 1990. He is surrounded by three hostile enemies, Iran, Turkey, and Israel, that are much more powerful than his weakened military. And he is facing the most powerful military force in the history of the world. His neighbors don't see him as a threat. His neighbors know him to be a survivor. He does not like to commit suicide. And yet, what we see here in Washington is a bizarre alignment. On the one hand, a majority of retired high military officials are counseling against war. They are represented by people like the former head of the Marine Corps, General Anthony Zinni, who says that Iraq is contained, it's deterred, it's surrounded. We have more important priorities in the Middle East, including settling the Arab-Israeli conflict. And yet on the other side, who is on the other side in and around George W. Bush? People who, when they were younger, supported the war in Vietnam, but wanted others to do the fighting as they became draft dodgers. People like George W. Bush dodged the draft. His daddy got him into the Air National Guard in Texas, and he hardly attended any meetings. The Air National Guard was not about to be deployed over Hanoi. Dick Cheney avoided the draft. Paul Wolfowitz avoided the draft. Elliot Abrams avoided the draft. John Ashcroft avoided the draft. These were not conscientious objectors. They were belligerent draft dodgers.
Consumer advocate Ralph Nader. While more than 100,000 peace activists descended on Washington and around the country for an anti-war protest this weekend, a handful of Americans were on an airplane to the Middle East. The group, a delegation of the Chicago-based organization Voices in the Wilderness, is on its way to Baghdad to bear witness in the event of a U.S. war on Iraq. From Amman, Jordan, Aaron Glantz reports.
15 American peace activists are about to go into Iraq. The activists are part of an Iraq peace team organized by the Chicago-based group Voices in the Wilderness. Tomorrow they will leave the Jordanian capital Amman by ground for Baghdad. Greg Shishu is one of them. He came to Amman from Golden, Colorado.
I'm a Chinese medical doctor. I do acupuncture, herbs, and massage. And I also work at a Compass Montessori school. I have a wife and two children as well, a 12-year-old girl and a 3-year-old girl.
Shishu says he wanted to come to Iraq to see conditions for regular people in Iraq with his own eyes. The United Nations estimates as much as 60% of Iraq's population could starve if the UN food basket program is disrupted.
To bring back, you know, to the United States as to really what I saw, what, you know, what's going on there. Are they really starving people, or are they living in palaces? You know, there's a lot of people in the United States, in my opinion, don't see that there's ordinary people in Iraq. They see it as just one person. Yeah, it's amazing that there's only two people in the world that are trying to duke it out with billions of dollars and hundreds of, you know, thousands of troops, perhaps, in the what's piling up over here.
Mary Shane is a stress management consultant from Cincinnati, Ohio. She closed her business for 3 weeks in order to make the trip to Iraq. She says even before she left, the trip had changed the perspective of those around her.
People who weren't really paying attention or understood what was going on when they heard that I was going, started to pay attention, started to ask questions, watch the news, challenge themselves on how they were perceiving what they were being told. So it started kind of an internal inquiry in a lot of the people that I knew, especially a lot of my clientele. I mean, I have a stress management business. And
expensive. Why would you go somewhere so stressful? But a lot of people really don't understand what's going on. So, I mean, the general feeling was people were very anxious to speak to me when I got back to see what I thought.
Peggy Gish is a Christian peace activist from Athens, Ohio. She just emerged from 2.5 months in Iraq. After a week and a half in Amman, she's decided to try to get a new visa for Iraq so she can be on the ground in the event of a possible war.
Part of my reason for being there was to do all I could do to try to keep a war from happening. Now, you can say, what can one person do, you know, and how can being there, you know, there's all kinds of questions that would come from that. But for me, that was probably the most I can do, is to put my body on the line, go and be there in the place of danger, be in the place of threat, and really learning to know the people, the place, the society, what's going on there. Getting deeply involved in with the issue, is probably as deeply as you can.
Gish says it's important to have American peace activists in Iraq to show the people of Iraq that not all Americans agree with President Bush and his plan for war. And she says Iraq is also the best place to speak a message of peace to the American people.
Part of that is to make a very clear statement to my country that that these people are deeply concerned. We know what we're talking about when we say the people are the ones who are going to suffer, not Saddam Hussein. It's not going to help fight terrorism. It's not going to make this world safer to have a war there. I mean, there's just all kinds of reasons I can give that there should not be a war. Okay, because we are there, our voice has a little more credibility for many people. We can make a very strong statement to people back home, to our country. We can say, we have seen these things with our own eyes. And so it's that kind of firsthand witness, firsthand.
The team of 15 peace activists leave for Iraq tomorrow. Another group of activists will head to Baghdad January 26th, a day before UN Weapons Inspector Hans Blix delivers his report to the United Nations Security Council. For Pacifica's Peace Watch, I'm Aaron Glantz in Amman, Jordan.
The Washington Times is reporting today that Secretary of State Colin Powell warned the United Nations against being, quote, shocked into impotence on Iraq. In a hastily called meeting, Powell told 13 of the 15 members of the council, we cannot fail to take the action because we are afraid of what others might do. Meanwhile, Task Force Iron Horse, the Army's most advanced land combat division, comprising 16,000 soldiers from the 4th Infantry and 20,000 supporting troops from 10 bases, is deploying a special unit to confront Iraq. By month's end, as many as 100,000 American troops may be positioned in the region, a total force of more than 200,000 soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines is expected to be in place or on the way by late February. You're listening to Pacifica's Peace Watch. I'm Verna Avery Brown. We'll be back in a moment.